Connected. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new bill in the state legislature would update the state's farmland preservation program. We'll talk to one of the bill's co-authors about how it works and what it would mean for farmers and non-farmers alike. First, we often talk in the media and here on this show about big issues related to mental health, access to treatment, peer support, and destigmatizing mental illness, for example. And the world of mental health care relies on individual case studies, clinical descriptions of patients, and their symptoms and treatment. But in a new book, our next guest does something different. She shares profiles of people who are dealing with a diagnosis of mental illness, who talk about their lives and the ways they understand that diagnosis. And she looks into wider connections between people and the societies they live in. In their stories and in her own story, she finds that simple categories don't always match up with complicated real-life experiences. She writes, quote, "They have come up against the limits of psychiatric ways of understanding themselves and are searching for the right scale of explanation." You can let us know what you think by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Have you or a loved one experienced mental illness? How did that affect how you think about yourself, your own identity? Did the medical explanations for your illness make sense to you, or were they difficult to process? You could email ideas@wpr.org. Rachel Aviv is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the book Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds, and the Stories That Make Us. I talked with her last month. You've been writing about mental health for years now, and you start the book with the story of your own experience at an early age, age six, diagnosed with an eating disorder and hospitalized for it. Can you talk a little bit about your story and how it led you to this book?
It was always something that I didn't know how to make sense of. When I was six, I stopped eating for a few days. I didn't really know why. I just was sort of refusing to do what the adults told me to do. And then my mom took me to a pediatrician, and it was the late 80s at that time. And anorexia was sort of a prevalent fear. And the pediatrician thought I had anorexia and told my mom to take me to the hospital. And then at the hospital, I was diagnosed with anorexia. And I was put on this unit of girls much older than me, who had also been diagnosed. But, you know, because I was 6 years old, I never heard that word. I had no idea sort of what made people lose weight or not. Like, it was all very obscure to me. And one of the things I'd always wondered was how much it felt almost like I learned to be anorexic because these older girls were offering themselves as mentors to me in a way. And I really looked up to them and admired them. And it was always something, you know, I kind of was able to recover and I started eating again and I moved on with my life. But I had always had this question of like, what happened to me in that hospital? I was there for 6 weeks. And it was hard to know what came first, whether like sort of being given the diagnosis of anorexia in a way reinforced or sort of encouraged certain behaviors because I had like a new identity among these girls for that period of time.
You have a reading for us. Looking at that experience, that of an older girl that you were there in the hospital with for anorexia and what led you on different paths. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. And just for a little context, mm-hmm. You know, when I was writing the book, I ended up learning about a woman named Hava who had been in the hospital with me. And I'd seen her as a kind of mentor. And I went back and interviewed her family and read her journals. So I'm sort of reflecting on this here. At 6 years old, it still seemed possible that I could become someone else through sheer will. Had I stayed in the hospital longer or returned to a less welcoming school, I may have followed Hava's path. "Labels aren't so bad," she wrote in her journal. "They at least give you a title to live up to and an identity." My stepmom, the most practical person in my family, has told me she was once doubtful that I'd make it to adulthood. I do have certain traits that make me susceptible to fasting for no reason, like an amorphous sense that self-restraint is a moral good. But I also wonder if I ever had anorexia in the first place. Maybe my limited exposure to the ideal of thinness prevented me from wanting it badly enough. To use the terms of the historian Joan Jacobs Brumberg, who has written eloquently about the genesis of eating disorders, I was recruited for anorexia, but the illness never became a career. It didn't provide the language with which I came to understand myself.
That's Rachel Aviv reading from her new book, Stranger to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds, and the Stories That Make Us. Can you talk about the stories of other people that you share in the book and the amazing access you had, either talking to people in person or their writings and their family members? What kind of stories were you seeking out here?
I think I was looking for people who similarly felt like they were moving in and out of different frameworks for trying to understand like this period of intense distress. I think, you know, an example would be in the last chapter, I write about a woman named Laura who had grown up in this wealthy community in Connecticut, and she'd gone to Harvard. And when she was at Harvard, she'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And for a period of time, she felt like bipolar disorder was her identity. Like it gave her, it sort of explained everything. Like every time she was sad, every time she had too much energy, it was all sort of channeled through the explanation of bipolar disorder. And over the course of 10 years, she ended up taking 19 different medications. Like every time she would come to the doctor, they would give her something new to try to help her. And at some point she realized that like she actually hadn't gotten better at all, that like none of this like extensive, you know, this sort of new way of seeing everything that was going wrong in her life, it wasn't actually making her better. So she started thinking about like who she was before all of this happened, and like whether there had been, you know, problems in her relationship with her family or her relationship with her culture, or her environment that was causing distress that like none of these medications could really touch, because like her illness was being treated purely as like a chemical problem.
I want to go into another story that you share of Ray, a man who was at the center of actually a lawsuit involving the question of what's the right way to deal with mental illness, psychoanalysis mm-hmm. at that point versus a biomedical model. Can you tell us a little bit about Ray's story, first of all?
Yeah, Ray is this, it was this really canonical case because in the late 70s, before antidepressants were widely used, Ray was admitted to this hospital called Chestnut Lodge in Maryland, and it was known as sort of the most elite place for psychoanalysis, and the entire hospital was devoted to psychoanalysis. And so he went there, and the doctors didn't use medications, and for 8 months, they tried to, you know, like figure out his relationship with his mother and sort of why that led to the problems in his life. He had been a very successful doctor. And after 7 months, his mother visited him at Chestnut Lodge and saw that he'd lost 40 pounds and that he'd sort of completely lost his identity. And she demanded medications, and Chestnut Lodge said no, that like they didn't think that was the problem. So Ray transferred to a different hospital where he was treated with antidepressants. And it was this sort of miraculous, like coming to life. Like in the course of 2 weeks, he kind of regained his sense of humor. He regained his love of reading. He kind of came back to himself. And so then he sued Chestnut Lodge for denying him medicine that he said, you know, he in the 7 months that he was denied medicine, he said that he kind of lost like the pieces of his life. His wife divorced him. He lost custody of his children. He lost his position at his job. And the case became this collision between two ways of understanding the mind, like the biological approach versus the psychoanalytic approach. And Ray ultimately sort of devoted his life to kind of getting revenge on this hospital. He felt like the hospital had taken away his life. And so in the book, I draw from his medical records, but also from this unpublished memoir that he essentially wrote for his entire life, because he felt like if he could finally tell his story, he would get some sort of vindication.
And this seems to be a theme in your book and in a lot of talk, I think, about mental health care lately, is that, you know, sometimes we have the one perfect solution. It's psychoanalysis or it's medication mm-hmm. or what have you. And for one person, sure, maybe. And for another person, it might be the yeah. opposite. That what I really take away from your stories is it's more than either of those, and it's more than both of those. What are you right. hoping people take away to add and understand how much more complicated it is?
Yeah, I think there is, psychiatry is often seen as this binary, like it's either, medical and you use medicine, or it's psychological and you kind of talk it out and you need to figure out your family dynamics. And I think those are two frameworks, and both can be true at the same time, but there are also other frameworks, like the way that discrimination affects a person's mind, or the way that sort of religious crises can like put you into a state of illness, or help you out of a state of illness. So I think that like there's this idea that you need to find one framework to explain what's wrong, and I wanted to show that like these frameworks are not mutually exclusive, and often it requires many at the same time to sort of help a person like refind their sense of meaning.
We're talking to Rachel Aviv about her new book. It's called Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. If you are willing to share an experience that this book, this conversation may be ringing a bell about for you or your own family, please do call in. If not, I totally understand. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rachel Aviv about her new book, Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds, and the Stories That Make Us. Rachel, you foreshadowed another one of the people in your book. I wanted to ask you about a woman from the Twin Cities, just across the border from here in Wisconsin, named Naomi. A tragic story, and you had mentioned looking at the impact of social inequality, of discrimination, as we talk about mental illness. Can you share a little of Naomi's story?
Yeah, Naomi was a young mother with four kids. When she was 21, she basically became convinced that government agents were kind of trying to attack her and her children. And she jumped off a bridge with her two twin sons, who are 14 months old. And she was arrested and put in prison. And the chapter is a lot about, the kind of this dynamic of like she had been asking for help leading up to this episode, and she had often been dismissed. Like the doctors would look at her and say, "Well, your life is extremely stressful." They wouldn't see her as actually having a mental illness because they thought there were like reasons in her life that she was so stressed out. And then after she was arrested, there was this dynamic of her trying to explain why she had reached this state of crisis. And one of the things going on was that, like in her psychosis, she felt like she was waking up to the racism in America and to the experience of being a Black mother in America raising children. And she kind of couldn't see between, like on the one hand, she was having these real insights about the way things work. And on the other hand, it was sort of psychotic in the sense that she lost track with reality. And, once she was arrested, she wanted to plead guilty, and say that she was insane, plead guilty by reason of insanity. But she wasn't allowed to because the doctor said, like, well, actually, the insights you have about the nature of society are true. So therefore, this person's not insane. And so she ended up in prison for many years. And the conversations I had with her were about kind of grappling with this confusing dynamic of like some of the things that were causing her distress were real, and you had like teasing apart what was an illness versus what was distress caused by the way she was raised and the kind of discrimination and trauma she had experienced. And I think that dynamic is really confusing and is one that psychiatrists sort of struggle to weed apart.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sandy is with us in Waukesha. Sandy, hello.
Hello. I wanted to just bring up something that's very relevant about healing. I went to Access Mental Health outpatient in Waukesha County. All the hospitals in the whole county would not take my insurance, so I would have to travel 35 miles for outpatient. And I've only been in outpatient three times. And so it's not like you know, just the access to care and people with mental health issues, they do need to tell their story. And that's what outpatient's about. And so I really think more people would get healthier or feel better about themselves if they had better access to care, because it is really a very serious problem.
Sandy, thank you so much for the call. Rachel, two things there. First of all, I heard you nodding along to just the difficulties with accessing care. Do you want to touch on that?
Right. I mean, it's like we can have the most amazing ideals of what constitutes good care, but if people can't access it and if our insurance doesn't cover it, then like it sort of doesn't exist. So I think that that is, you know, the way that insurance limits care is really profound. And I think a lot of the inability of people to tell their stories and have someone hear their stories has to do with the limits that are placed on like doctors because of the way that the reimbursement scheme is structured.
And Sandy also mentioned the importance of, as you just said, people telling their stories. And that definitely rang with me reading your book. You're telling your own story and you're sharing, as you mentioned, Ray's memoir, Naomi's firsthand accounts, other people's writings over the years. How important is storytelling to helping people find their identity after, for example, a diagnosis of mental illness?
I mean, I'm a writer, so I obviously think like storytelling is extremely important for, you know, our sense of self. But I think that, you know, when you have an illness, it can be a kind of rupture in the story that you have of yourself. And you had certain ideas of who you were and who you were supposed to become. And then a diagnosis like changes those ideas. And I think sometimes that diagnosis can change those ideas in a good way and makes you feel kind of liberated and a sense of relief that like, there's a way of understanding yourself that is generative. But I think other times a diagnosis can feel like someone sort of imposing a story on you from outside, and it doesn't feel right, and it feels limiting, and it feels like you're sort of trapped. So I did think that as people, the people that I wrote about, as they began to recover, it did feel like part of that was like rewriting their story of themselves and feeling comfortable with that and feeling like they owned that.
Sandy, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us. We are talking to Rachel Aviv. Her new book is called Strangers to Ourselves. Let's bring on another caller. Rose is with us in Chippewa Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi. I was just calling because I wanted to mention that I'm bipolar, and I had a psychiatrist from Harvard, and he thought he was special and could treat me, and he just did a horrible job, and I ended up getting another psychiatrist that was a whole lot better than the professional Harvard man. And I just wanted to mention that just because they're professionals doesn't mean that they're always great.
Rose, thanks so much for sharing that. I'm glad you found a better experience, a better treatment, and I appreciate you sharing that. Rachel, the ability to move around and find maybe a different treatment is going to work more for me than maybe somebody else. How important is that to be able to do?
Well, I do think it's interesting that, you know, something that came up in the stories that I wrote were like that we have this idea, you know, that you're alone, you're in a mental health crisis, and you need a psychiatrist to help you. And that may be very true, but sometimes the help that people got wasn't necessarily from an expert. It was like from a friend or from someone who had gone through mental illness themselves. Or, I mean, let me just clarify, like that it wasn't that they, you know, the psychiatrist or the doctor is the only one who can prescribe medicine. But I just noticed that, like, you know, in terms of telling one's story and feeling heard and feeling a sense of like fellowship, I think that that can come from non-expertise, that can come from other people who've had mental illness. Or I think for Naomi, like she, the woman that was in prison, she developed this incredible relationship with the prison librarian. And through that relationship, she kind of felt less alone and felt like she understood her own experiences better. So I think that's like, it's an unfortunate thing that so often like the one person who we feel comfortable telling our stories to is in a position of, you know, maybe not being the right person to like receive it.
Rose, thanks for sharing your story. Rachel, there are a lot of things I think to take away from your book and no simple, easy answers, but it seems like one thing that we keep coming back to is the importance of our social connections as mm-hmm. we deal with a diagnosis of mental illness or concerns about it. In our last minute or so, can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I think it's isolation and loneliness that is not just, you know, that really exacerbates mental illness in a profound way. And it's the sense of like finding a community or finding someone who doesn't think, you know, like mental illness can make you feel like you sort of exist outside of the social world. And I noticed that as people recovered, it was because they were sort of being drawn back into the social world through one or another method. And it didn't have to be the same method, but like it just felt like there was a way in which I think we've all underlooked like how healing a community is.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing these stories with us.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Aviv, staff writer for The New Yorker. She talked to us about her new book. It's called Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. Coming up after the news, a co-author of a bill updating Wisconsin's farmland preservation program joins the show to share how it works. And then we'll look at some of the biggest preservation and conservation challenges facing farmers here in the state. If we're talking about you, we'd love to hear from you. If you are a farmer, do you participate in this farmland preservation program or do something else when it comes to sustainable farming? And in your community, are you seeing more farmland get turned into something else other than farming? Love to hear from you. You can email right now at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we recap the National Curling Club Championships held this weekend in Wausau. Now, lawmakers in Wisconsin are proposing an update to the state's farmland preservation program to give more farmers an incentive to participate. The program offers tax credits to farmers to keep their land for farming use as opposed to selling it off for commercial, industrial, or other development. The goal is to maintain more land in Wisconsin for farming and agriculture while also meeting sustainability standards. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer, we'd love to hear from you about your experiences with land preservation and conservation. If you are watching in your community, are you seeing a lot of former farmland turned into something else? What do you think about that? Do you want to see efforts to keep farmland? Farmland. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Oldenburg is a Republican state assembly representative from the 96th district in western Wisconsin. He's co-author of the bill to update the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program, which his own farm in Viroqua has participated in. Representative Oldenburg, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you today.
Now, this program has been around in its current state for a while now. Can you give us the basics on how it works?
Well, I started this program on my farm in 2009. Actually had to write a 590 nutrient plan, which a 590 nutrient plan is the same thing as these big farmers, big CAFOs and everything have to follow. And then also goes on and you have to implement it. You know, you got to do a soil testing, soil sampling, and that will, then you got to put a SNAP plus two program. And then it shows how much soil you're actually losing. And also with a soil test, what kind of nutrients do you have to put back into soil to get your projected yield, what you want to do in that. So we don't over-fertilize and we save soil. And that's kind of the idea behind farmland preservation. It's as far as taking soil samples, you can hire it done, can do it yourself, send it in, and then you actually can implement it within yourself through the SNAP Plus 2 program. It's a computer program that UW Extension created for this. And it's a little time consuming, but other than that, I think the benefit is huge. Everyone should be soil sampling your crops anyway, or your land. So we don't over fertilize and get the maximum yield out without spending too much money.
So you're speaking of one of the two goals, as I understand it, Representative Oldenburg, that, you know, preserving soil quality, and this is going to have impacts on water quality as well. Also, if I get it right, this program, the goal is to keep farmland as farmland. Can you talk about that part of the program?
Well, you know, that's the thing, you know, one part of this program, if your township is zoned and zone exclusive ag, you can get in this program without having any other neighborly farms in this program. So it's just on a yearly basis that way. Then if you do an enterprise and agricultural zone area, that where you have to have other farmers also with you and get a certain amount of acres to do that. That way this program, this new bill that we put out last week or a couple of weeks ago, would reduce that timeline to 15 years to 10 years. That idea is get more farmers involved, because when we did a survey back in 2018, that was one of the things that farmers didn't want to sign up for 15 years, case, you know, either sold your land or something else has happened, they could not get out and stuff like that. So, well, the biggest idea of this is actually help the farmers, smaller farmers, big farmers, actually get some beneficial tax credit out of this. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason why we are raising the tax credits on this, because of that was one of the issues that farmers got back to us, is that it wasn't worth their time to do that. So that's the beneficial of maybe put some more dollars in the farmers to actually be able to stay on the land longer, so they don't end up selling the land to a developer or some other entity.
Can you talk a little more about the changes in your new legislation that you're working on? You hit the key point there. I think that's upping the per acre tax credit for people who participate. Are you hoping that's going to be enough to, you know, overcome some of that hesitation you were just talking about from farmers?
I think it'll be a big step forward. I think especially going, if you're in an agricultural enterprising zone or entity, that was only $5 if you were not, your township wasn't zoned. That'll go up to $10. You know, that's huge. And you got to remember, you maybe have 100 acres of crop land, then you have maybe 100 acres of woods. So that's 200 acres. You get tax credit on the whole thing, just not the land that you actually farm in. So that is very beneficial to the landowner, that, hey, I want to keep it small. I want to keep it, you know, at this size, because I do get that extra tax credit, and then where we can, you know, beneficial of the whole thing.
Talking to Representative Lauren Oldenburg from Western Wisconsin, Assembly Representative, looking at a program in Wisconsin aimed at conserving and preserving farmland. It's called the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program. He's working on legislation to expand it, hopefully bring more farmers, he says, on board with it. Representative Oldenburg, it sounds like one possibility is, you know, I know farmers are busy people, and they might look at this and say, well, it sounds like a lot of bureaucracy. Is this really worth my time?
I don't believe it is bureaucracy. I mean, it's, you get paid. I mean, you get tax credit when you go file your taxes in February or March, whenever you have to do that. Right off the bottom line, you know, you get the sheet from your land conservation office, say you finished your program, your 590 nutrient program, and through the whole process, they sign off on it. You give that to your tax person. You take that tax credit right off your tax, you know, taxes. So, and if you don't pay any taxes, you actually get a check from the state of Wisconsin. So, I mean, it is beneficial. It's a little bit of time, but everyone should be doing their new soil testing. That's probably your biggest time anyway. You get double benefit. You get a tax credit on that. And then you also know what nutrients is required to raise that crop. So I think it's just a little bit of time. I think it's a little bit of education to say, hey, this program is out there. And I think if any farmers listening to this, reach out to your land conservation offices, you're at the local county level, and say, hey, I'm interested, and see what you have to do.
I wanted to ask about the county conservation offices. As I understand it, they're the ones who say, you know, every now and then they go and check it out and say, yes, you've got this plan, this conservation plan in place. Are there enough of them? Is there enough county conservation officer to go around to implement this program?
Well, I've been very fortunate up here where I represent Crawford County, Vernon County, and part of Monroe County, have three great leads there and stuff. And there's also a bill that's going through that would fully fund those programs at 170 and 50 to get more dollars to the county level, so they actually could fund those land conservation offices. So I think it's vital, especially here in Western Wisconsin, make sure the farmers are doing a good job on the land, preserving the soil, and make sure the water's clean. I think they are very helpful individuals and group of people that the farmers should be leaning on if possible.
As you talk to your fellow farmers, Representative Oldenburg, I mean, in general, this program aside, do you hear a lot of interest in preserving, you know, soil quality and local water quality?
Big time. I mean, this last year, I was the first time I don't have a lot of time. I put cover crops in, and I plan to continue to do that going forward. And I think that has taken off big time, cover crops. And you can implement this in the farmland preservation to get your soil loss down there where it needs to be. If you have some steep slopes where I live up here, and also it's good nutrients for soil health. Cover crop has probably taken off in the last 5 to 10 years. Something that I think is just a start, and I think it will continue to be a practice that farmers will put in their rotation. I think there's going to be more and more creative ways of how to get that cover crop on in a timely fashion going forward. That's always the challenge up here where, you know, we get an early winter or early fall that we can't get these cover crops started. That's the biggest challenge up here is getting the cover crops on timely fashion.
And when farmers are coming up with their conservation plans, is there like a one size fits all, or is it going to look different in a place like, Viroqua area, where you've got that rolling country and more slopes versus, you know, flatter parts of the state or different crops or what have you?
Definitely. I mean, that's what you implement this program where it fits your rotations and where your land lays. Yes, cover crops, when you get further south, you can get those crops in sooner and quicker and get established. So I think, yes, everyone's farm will be different. I think cover crops have really come a long ways on dairy farmers that actually get their corn silage off in, you know, maybe end of September, mid-September, and they can get a cover crop established there. And I bet they're seeing big time advantages of that.
And Representative Oldenburg, as we wrap up, I understand you've got some bipartisan support here, some support from rural and urban districts in the state. What is your timeline? When are you hoping to get this thing done and voted on?
I hope to get this voted on. It's kind of a unique, it's an appropriation, it's dollars, so you always have to deal with joint finance. So I would love to get this done before the budget process or within the budget process. Get the bill passed and then get it funded through the budget. So hopefully it's done by the time the budget is done. That would be July 1st.
Representative Oldenburg, thanks again for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That's Representative Lauren Oldenburg, Republican serving Wisconsin's 96th district in the state assembly, a farmer in Viroqua, with us today to tell us more about his bill that would expand the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Project. Up next, two experts on farmland conservation and preservation practices join us to talk more about some of the challenges farmers might face to maintain their land, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the state put more emphasis on preserving farmland and on conservation efforts for soil and water quality in rural areas? Why is that important to you? How does it affect your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about farmland preservation and conservation here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your questions, maybe your own experiences as a farmer. What kind of things do you do to help maintain soil and water quality? What are ways that the state or federal governments, if any, could help you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Diane Meyerfield joins us now, Sustainable Agriculture Coordinator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension, also the Wisconsin State Coordinator of the USDA Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. Diane, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Allison Volk is the Land Protection Project's Deputy Director at American Farmland Trust. Before that, she oversaw the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program that we were just talking about as part of the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Allison, we were just talking about the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program. You used to oversee that. What kind of things did you hear from Wisconsin farmers who participated?
I think we learned from farmers that the tax credit for participating in the program really wasn't enough to help incentivize continuing to be in the program. We also, you know, heard that implementing practices like adopting nutrient management plans, it's expensive. And so having that tax credit available can really help support farmers as they adopt these practices that are so beneficial to water quality and the preservation of farmland.
And Diane, is this a common story you hear that, you know, farmers might want to up their sustainability game, but can't, those initial expenses might be a little high?
Well, absolutely. I talk about a range of sustainable practices, and the question does always come up about what is the cost to farmers up front? And a lot of times with these sustainability things, there are higher costs up front. There may be economic benefits in the long term, but it's hard to ask a farmer to do something and carry those losses early, hoping that in 4 or 5 years it'll start paying back.
And Allison, do you think this idea we just heard from Representative Oldenburg of nudging up those per acre tax credits, is it something like that? You think something that'll push more farmers over the edge and say, yeah, I'll give this a try?
I think so. I think it certainly couldn't hurt to increase those levels and to keep them increasing with inflation.
Now, Diane, you work directly with farmers and people who train farmers. What are some of the most common sustainability practices that you see Wisconsin farmers taking up?
Well, Representative Oldenburg mentioned one of them, which is cover cropping. In the past 10 years, really, the interest in cover crops has really grown enormously, from something people didn't even really think about to a significant percentage of Wisconsin farmers doing it. But that's only one of a huge suite of conservation practices, starting with things like reducing tillage and planting cover crops and putting in other conservation practices, to things like agroforestry, where you're integrating trees in your cropping system, maybe planting more windbreaks or even planting rows of trees around in the middle of regular farm fields. That's called alley cropping. So there are literally dozens of conservation practices that farmers can do and are doing in Wisconsin.
Allison, we've been talking mostly about the sustainability part of the equation here. As I understand it, some of the work you do at the American Farmland Trust has to do with keeping farmers on the land and land in work in agriculture. What are some of the biggest challenges to doing that?
Affordability and access to land is a big concern. You know, we have a large population of farmers who are retiring. And in Wisconsin, there's three times as many producers over 65 as under 35 years old. And we really need to make sure that there's farmland available for those emerging producers to have access to.
We are talking about conserving and sustaining farmland here in Wisconsin. Allison Volk is with us from the American Farmland Trust, and Diane Meyerfield with UW-Madison Division of Extension. Diane, first day of spring today. What kind of things should be on farmers' minds as they start to think about, you know, keeping their farming as sustainable as possible?
Well, definitely nutrient management, making sure that any fertilizer and any manure applications are not more than the plants need to grow. And so that's number one. Farmers have been thinking a lot more about soil health in general and practices that can increase the amount of carbon in their soils. And so as we approach the planting season, it means also being very aware of the moisture levels of the soils before you run heavy equipment on them. Sometimes the weather just absolutely doesn't cooperate, but that's an important consideration too. And there's a whole range of practices that can benefit soil health. Not all of them in things that are front of mind in the spring, like keeping the soil covered all year round and having a more diverse crop rotation are some examples.
Allison, I understand one tool you work with at the Farmland Trust is conservation easements. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. Conservation easements are deed restrictions that farmers voluntarily will put on their land to ensure that the land remains permanently available for agricultural use. And they remove the development rights and reimburse the farmer for those development rights. Oftentimes, the farmer is then able to reinvest that funding in their operation, and the money can stay in the community. And, you know, if you know, and it ties into kind of what Diane is talking about, because if you know that land is going to remain in agricultural use and available for agricultural use, the more apt a farmer is to invest in the health of that land by then implementing those conservation practices.
We heard from Debbie in Franklin, who couldn't stay on the line. She says her municipality is one of the few in Milwaukee County that still has farmland, and her community really wants to see more farmland preservation efforts, like the program we were talking about, the Wisconsin Preservation Program. Allison, I want to ask you about that in particular. At a place where, you know, a piece of land might look a lot more lucrative and valuable being developed for something other than farmland, is that an area you focus on, keeping at least some of that kind of that land in agriculture as cities start to encroach on it?
It depends. You know, the conservation easement has to be used in tandem with other land use tools, such as planning and zoning, because the last thing we want to do is create an island of farming that's surrounded by a development where the farmer can't farm because there's no farming neighbors. So we really need to try to create a balance between farming and development, and then to make sure that we're not acting too late so that we're protecting farmland that's nearby other farmland.
Diane, for farmers who might like to participate in state or federal conservation programs and maybe don't know where to start, what kind of help is available for them in Wisconsin to get connected?
There's a lot of resources. Representative Oldenburg mentioned the county soil and water conservation programs. So starting with your county, Extension also has agricultural advisors in almost every county of the state. And then there are a range of federal programs that, among other things, can provide financial support for a whole host of conservation practices. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture Natural Resources Conservation Service is in every county in the state, and they do both technical advice and in some cases financial assistance for conservation practices, ranging everything from improving manure storage to some of these, you know, really sort of innovative agroforestry practices and things like planting strips of prairie on the farm.
And Allison,
and then the program I work with, mm-hmm. Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education, is a national program, but that doesn't so much give technical assistance, but for the farmers who are really out there on the cutting edge, there's some good information, and there's also a grant program that SAIR runs that can help farmers try out new and innovative practices.
And we'll leave it there. Diane, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Allison, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Diane Meyerfield, Sustainable Agriculture Coordinator for the UW-Madison Division of Extension, and Allison Volk is the Land Protection Project's Deputy Director at American Farmland Trust. Been talking about efforts to preserve Wisconsin farmland and to help farmers conserve soil and water quality. Earlier, we heard from State Assembly Representative Lauren Oldenburg, who's sponsoring legislation on the issue, specifically a Wisconsin project called the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Project. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, join the weekly series on cooking. It's Food Tuesday, with a focus this week on cast iron cookware. You can join in with your questions, how to clean the darn things. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. I was off last week. I always look forward to vacations, sure, but then I get ready to go and I look at the conversations we have on the schedule here on Central Time and I think, ah, wish I got to do that one. Well, last week was no exception. Among the conversations I missed, a great talk about movies that are so bad, they're good. You shared some of your favorites. Here are some more that you posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jimmy writes, I just love Z-Grade, and the most legendary of them all is the iconic Canadian campy classic, Werewolf Fever. Robert says, saw a really great, good, bad holiday movie this past Christmas season, Santa Games. It tried to capitalize on the very awesome holiday movie Elf, because Will Ferrell says no way to Elf 2. Features the actor who played the store manager in Elf. Bad acting, close to zero plot, but it sucked us in and led to a two-hour discussion after watching it. We plan on making it a holiday tradition. And James says, if you want so bad it's good cinema, check out the works of Neil Bream. I used to be into bad movies, mostly moved on. Watched a lot of Mystery Science Theater back in the day, though. So bad it's good. This is Central Time.